Support for Access Utah comes from the Utah Humanities Council, enriching cultural, intellectual, and civic life by providing opportunities for all Utahns to explore life's most engaging questions and the wonders of the human experience.
Welcome to Access Utah. This is Sherry Quinn. Utah is the only state in the U.S. to enact a law that requires someone who is engaged in bioprospecting to notify the Utah Division of Forestry, Fire, and State Lands before removing certain microorganisms, plants, or fungi from state land. Bioprospecting is the search for and collection of biological material, usually microbes, that could prove either economically useful or in environmental protection efforts. For example, if extreme algae living in Great Salt Lake can make a biofuel without impacting the ecosystem, it can be harnessed in the laboratory. Since research may turn those algae into a profitable fuel, the new law lays the groundwork for Utah to benefit from profits made off the research. Westminster's Great Salt Lake Institute helped draft the legislation and was recently the first to utilize it. Bonnie Baxter, professor of biology at Westminster College and director of the Great Salt Lake Institute, joins us to discuss this new law and new management strategies for Great Salt Lake.
A number of us in the state got together and formed a committee to put together legislation that became the Bioprospecting Act. It was introduced by Senator Lyle Hilliard last year. And the impetus for this was that a number of us were working on microbes from extreme areas in the state. By extreme, I mean extreme environments, from glaciers or from cryptobiotic soil or desert varnish or, in my case, from Great Salt Lake. We were working on these things, and we realized that lots of other researchers were interested in Utah's extreme environments, and we wondered if there was a way to sort of keep some of this research in the state, or at least its development for economic potential. The concept of bioprospecting, maybe I should explain that a little bit. Around the world, people go into environments, and most people are familiar with the scenario of collecting plants in the rainforest and looking for natural products that might be useful as medicines. In that case, sometimes you have to cut down the plant or harvest the fruit or the seeds. In the case of microorganisms, they're reproducing so quickly that they are a renewable resource. So we used to get the cancer drug Taxol from cutting down 200-year-old yew trees in the Pacific Northwest, but then we found microbes that could produce the same compounds. And that makes the production of those compounds really cheap. And you don't hurt the environment because the microbes are constantly renewing. So we've found some interesting microbes in Great Salt Lake that might be producing something that could be useful for biofuels and alternative energy sources like hydrogen. So we've been very interested in the algae that's growing at these extreme salinities, because sometimes when life has to exist at the edge, like it does in the north arm of Great Salt Lake, in particular, it has to invent energy strategies. And we think that those are good candidates then to look for secrets, for things like that.
And so with this Bioprospecting Act, what are the parts of it that protect the resources more?
Right. So does it make it more exploitive? So we really don't expect the behavior of scientists who are working on these things to change dramatically. You know, scooping a little bit of water or sand, going back to the laboratory and cultivating the organisms out of that. That's usually what it looks like. So we don't really expect an impact on any of these environments. But what we do now expect with the Bioprospecting Act is that the people who are sampling on state lands in Utah will have to register with the state and say where they sampled. This helps the state know where people are on state lands, and it also helps in case there is technology that comes out of one of these experiments, they would be expected to give Utah credit. And in the future, there will be a phase two introduced in legislation that will suggest that these people that are sampling in the state of Utah develop their technologies in Utah, which is the economic piece of this. That legislation hasn't happened yet. And there would be, you know, a percentage of the patent that would, the royalties from the patent that would come back to the state of Utah if the technology is developed outside of Utah. But if you develop that in the state, then you wouldn't have to pay that percentage of the royalties to the state. So that sort of keeps the economics within the state. And that's the purpose. This is sort of step one, the Registration Act. And then we would move forward to something later that really is more about the economic development of any technologies. And I might just add that this was modeled after something that happened at Yellowstone Park. And so it's modeled after the National Park Service registration model. A pretty incredible technology came out of microbiological sampling in Yellowstone. We got TAC polymerase, which scientists developed something called PCR, which is now used for all diagnostic testing for genes and for forensics, and it's been a multi-billion dollar industry. And Yellowstone National Park got nothing out of it. And so they began this registration process. So no other state is doing this, but the National Park Service does do this.
Biofuels are the most exciting prospect for scientists right now. But Baxter says the microbes in the north arm of the lake that color the water pink are promising too.
They have these carotenoid pigments in them, which a lot of people are interested in as nutritionals because they're antioxidants. So that's a possibility, and also using those compounds as sunscreens. We've been really looking hard at why these organisms are so resistant to UV light, and we think that they have very active DNA repair processes. So that's kind of cool. They have enzymes that fix their damage to DNA, and at a higher rate than our enzymes work. So they're doing DNA repair better. They're fixing any damage they get. But these pigments are working much like skin pigmentation works in humans. People who are less pigmented are more likely to get skin cancer. So melanin pigmentation protects us from skin cancer, and that's why the peoples who evolved around the equator and stayed in those areas, there was selection for darker skin colors. So we see organisms that live their life in high UV light, they tend to be pigmented. It just can't be a mistake that they're using them to shield UV light. So we have connected that to DNA damage. If we can modify them in the lab so that they have less pigmentation, and when we do that, they accumulate more DNA damage. So we can actually produce that result in the lab. And so we've been stuck at kind of those molecular questions and looking at what's going on inside the cell. In terms of the marketing of that idea or taking that forward into the nutraceutical industry, we haven't gone any further with that at this time. So yeah. Those are some potential projects we see on the horizon.
The lake is filled with bioresources, some that are extracted by the tons every year. Understanding the ecosystem and keeping it healthy is key. Baxter is part of a council created by Governor Huntsman to conduct scientific studies at the lake and to recommend management strategies.
So I've been on that science panel, and a number of us have been meeting this fall. And it's been facilitated by a remarkable person who does this in environments all over the world to kind of pinpoint what are the hallmarks of health, because that's never been done on an ecosystem like Great Salt Lake. So there's so many question marks. And he's guided us through a process of sort of indicating what will be the target species that we need to look to ask about health. And that could be a plant, that could be a microbe, that could be a bird. And then what are the stressors on those systems, and where are we now, and is now healthy, is now not healthy. And so we're having to go through each parameter of the science of the lake and determine what is health and what is not health. And so the results of the study are going to be presented mid-January to the Great Salt Lake Advisory Council, and then they will be talking to the legislature about that.
Great Salt Lake is a terminal lake, and so everything in the valley can end up settling in there. Baxter says she learned it has a memory.
I just love that. I It's stuck with me that the lake has a memory of all the activities that have occurred in the valley, because everything goes into the lake. So that can be a bad memory or a good memory, right? The whole concept of Great Salt Lake Institute has been so interesting as we've been evolving and developing, because we take a real holistic view, which would include industry as well as environmental groups, as well as researchers and legislators and you know, everybody in the state, and whoever has a connection to the lake, no matter how it is, and it's all in one big envelope, whether it's a good interaction or a bad interaction or a benign interaction, you know. So it's kind of interesting. I see the lake in a different way now, I think, than I did a few years ago.
With so many industries surrounding the lake that are extracting its resources, Baxter sees the ecosystem as a valuable economic source, but also one that needs thoughtful protection.
There are a number of mineral extraction companies around the lake, and we don't make any table salt here, but Morton has a plant, and Cargill and Great Salt Lake Minerals. Great Salt Lake Minerals is making potash for fertilizer. Morton and Cargill, they're making salts for things like water softeners. And there's another plant, Intrepid, that's out near Tooele. So different mineral extraction company, U.S. Magnesium's getting magnesium out of the lake, which is a product in steel. So the lake is supplying a lot of minerals for a lot of the things that we use. And there has to, of course, be a balance of that, right? How much extraction is too much? And that was a big discussion in this science panel that I was on. You know, do we know what the health of, you know, what is a healthy amount of minerals to have in the lake? Because minerals are constantly flowing into the lake. So we've got to have a balance, right? You can't take too much out, because otherwise you deplete the system. So those are important questions, and I think that's where Great Salt Lake likes to facilitate discussion is okay, so some is good because we use fertilizers and we use salts and we use steel. Everybody uses steel, right? So to say that we're going to suddenly have a lake that has no industry on it, I think, is a pipe dream, and it's an idealist perspective. So if you encompass the industry, then you need to work in harmony with the lake. And so that's one set of industries. The Artemia Association represents a number of brine shrimp companies, and they harvest the brine shrimp cysts, these encysted embryos that then they deliver to particularly prawn farming in like Southeast Asian countries or Thailand and other places that these are used to feed prawns as they're grown for culture. So for cultivation for food. So brine shrimp cysts are actually helping feed a lot of people in the world, which is kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. So again, it's an industry that people rely on, but it needs to be in harmony with the lake. And that is done through the Division of Wildlife Resources Great Salt Lake Ecosystem Project. They work together with the Artemia Association to decide when and where harvest will happen, mm-hmm. and for how long. And so all of these issues are management issues that take place at the state level. The problem that John Huntsman saw, and I think a number of other of us saw, is that all the management of these things happens in different pockets. And so I guess one of the public awareness pieces would be there's not one governing body for the lake, and that's kind of crazy. You know, some of this comes through the Clean Water Act, which is managed through the Division of Water Quality. Some of this comes through the Division of Wildlife Resources. Some of this comes through forestry, fire, state lands, because the lake bed is a state lands. But the lake itself is a public trust by the federal government. There's a railroad, which is completely different, that bisects the lake. So the management of the lake is in a lot of different pockets. And part of creating this Great Salt Lake Advisory Council was to help pull all that together. And I don't think until I got involved with the government piece of this that I quite understood how fractured it is. How can you manage a lake in so many different, you know, agencies with their own structure, you know, and they don't talk to each other because the structure doesn't necessitate that, right? And it's that part is sad. And I think the Great Salt Lake Advisory Council has the charge and can function as a body that pulls all those groups together. And anymore in the last 5 years, we're, lots of us are meeting in the same room all the time for various reasons about the lake. And that's amazing. That's been really great. So I'm hopeful. But issues come up, like the railroad causeway is failing. So Union Pacific decides they're going to replace this piece of the railroad causeway. And they have the purview to do that. And they can decide what the flow of water will be beneath it, if it should be free-flowing, if it should be a straight causeway. If it's free-flowing, that changes the entire lake, but it restores it to something closer to what it used to be. So which is the right answer, right? So Union Pacific can do that without asking anybody in the state. But they did ask people in the state, what do you want? You've got 3 months, and then we're going to build the causeway. So people meet and people talk, and nobody really, because we don't know the science of the lake that well, no one really knows the answer to what is the best scenario. So it has to be modeled. It has to be thought about. And, you know, will saltier water flowing from the North Arm change the brine shrimp harvest? Because the shrimp don't like it that salty. We don't know. It's really interesting. So I think the problems on the horizon that I hope are going to be fixed is, I hope we're going to start answering a lot of those we don't know questions. And I think we're going to start pulling together all of the units that manage the lake, and have some more consistent management of the lake. And I think the public should be actively watching that and being involved in that.
One of the problems to pay close attention to is the amount of heavy metals in the lake.
There is a severe mercury problem in Great Salt Lake, and certainly coal burning contributes to that, but where we think it's coming from is gold mining, because mercury is a natural airborne byproduct, and so its atmospheric deposition of mercury from, you know, nearby gold mining is the most likely example, because you've got this huge body of water, and as the atmosphere, you know, that we share, you know, deposits mercury, and it can interact with the lake in a chemical way to make the mercury soluble. And that mercury can get converted into an organic form that can be taken up by biology. So the microbes can process it and create a more toxic form that then can move up the food chain.
Right. I've heard about the issue with the ducks.
Exactly. And so kudos to the duck hunters. They're really the people who have pushed this research. And most of it's going through USGS, so it's a federally funded analysis of the mercury, although the state is now putting a lot of money towards it. In fact, Great Salt Lake Institute has funding for a grant this year from the Forestry Fire State Land Division. And we are looking at some of the microbes who are converting this mercury into toxic forms. So the mercury issue is one that is clearly something that we need more research on, and we need to point people in the direction of. So that's an example of the kind of thing that Great Salt Lake Advisory Council can do. They can find an issue and say, this is an issue that's really critical. If they had a budget, they could then say, you know, we would like to have an open call for proposals for this issue, and we would fund science to come up with a deliverable in a year that helps us mediate this problem.
Selenium, too. That was
selenium is another issue.
Another big one.
Yeah. And the selenium issue was funded and looked at, and now we have a standard set for the lake of how much selenium is too much. But there's still analysis by USGS of where it's coming from, because selenium is a point source in the lake, because it's coming from tailings from copper mining. It's a point source for where that outflow is, whereas mercury is atmospheric deposition, so it's all over the lake. But it's concentrated in this area near the causeway that we call the deep brine layer. There's a hypersalty area that's underneath the South Arm water that seems to be concentrating this mercury. So understanding that, where these issues are, where we take measurements, what is healthy, what is not healthy, that is the cool work that is going to be done in the next couple of years. That's going to be really incredibly fascinating. And then we'll actually have a set of parameters that we need to keep the lake in. We've never had that before. It's just so unique. It's so different that you can't use the standards that are set for freshwater where people fish and drink. You have to create your own set of standards. it's a good time for the lake, I think. I think it's getting a lot of attention from a science perspective, and that's what we've been waiting for.
That was Bonnie Baxter, professor of biology at Westminster College in Salt Lake City. Stay tuned for Science Questions. Up next, Sherry Quinn, Access Utah. Welcome to the Beehive Archive, a two-minute look at some of the most pivotal and peculiar events in Utah's history. I'm Megan Van Frank. Ghost towns of the Old West are generally relics of the mining industry, but this week learn about a now-deserted cow town called Old LaSalle. First this.
The Beehive Archive is brought to you on Utah Public Radio by the Utah Humanities Council, with support from a We the People grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities and the Lawrence T. and Janet T. D. Foundation.
Situated in the northeast corner of San Juan County, at the foot of the LaSalle Mountains, Old LaSalle was once a thriving cow town. First settled in 1877, more than 20 families arrived within the first year to take advantage of the exceptional grazing in the nearby mountain range. Cabins were built and the town of LaSalle came into existence. During the next few years, the valleys of the regions filled with more settlers and their cattle. Steers sold for $10 per head in Utah, but brought in more than three times that amount just over the line in Colorado. Profits began to pour into the pockets of the LaSalle ranchers. During the 1880s and 90s, however, conflict arose between the ranchers and the Ute Indians accessing their ancestral lands. Outlaws also moved in to prey upon the district, sometimes rustling whole herds of cattle. To make matters worse, the ranchers then faced several years of drought and falling cattle markets. These economic troubles ushered in an era of sheep raising that displaced cattle as the region's primary industry. The final straw for the town of LaSalle was the annual threat of extinction by floods down Main Street. By the late 1920s, LaSalle residents went looking for a safer, less isolated site. They packed up everything and moved some miles west to Coyote. The town was stripped of its houses, stores, barns, and corrals. They even took its name, and the town of Coyote was renamed LaSalle. Today, Old LaSalle is a ghost town lacking even ghosts. The old site is marked only by gaping cellars to show that people once lived there. The thousands of cattle that once passed through to Colorado markets are seen no more, and only an occasional flock of sheep visits the deserted site. Content for this episode of the Beehive Archive was provided by the Utah State Historical Society. Sources and past episodes of the Beehive Archive may be found at utahhumanities.org. For the Beehive Archive, a production of the Utah Humanities Council, I'm Megan Van Frank. Visit us online at upr.org and click on the Beehive Archive link.
Support for Access Utah comes from Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now with new hours, open Monday through Saturday 7 until 3 and Saturday 8 until 3, offering a changing menu of French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits and serving lunch sandwiches.
Coming up on the next Bluegrass Breakdown, he's a superstar, Opry mainstay, singer of 12 number one songs, winner of numerous awards, and lover and connoisseur of the high blue and lonesome sound. I'm Dave Higgs, and Joe Diffie will be joining us live on the next Bluegrass Breakdown.
That's Saturday night at 10 here on Utah Public Radio.
Support for Science Questions comes from USU's College of Science, advancing the educational experience of future scientists with advanced research in the lab, field, and outer space. When students and faculty learn together, discovery follows. Information is at usu.edu/science.
Welcome to Science Questions. I'm Susie Montgomery.
And I am Sherry Quinn.
It is not unusual to see groups of seniors in St. George, Utah. But how about seeing a group of the first conservationists of the United States of America, averaging 90 years old and passing the conservation torch to the younger generations? These men are the CCC, the Civilian Conservation Corps, who built most of our nation's trails, dams, and bridges during the Depression era.
Of the roughly 20,000 men who comprise the Corps from 1933 to 1938, about 1,000 are still living, and a dozen made their way across the nation to attend a CCC legacy gathering where they toured their old camps.
I spent 18 months in one camp, and I got out, and there was still no work around, so I went back in. Went to a camp in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, and they were just about ready to close, and they shipped us all up in the North Adams mess. But it was a great experience. And if the kids could do it today, good luck to them.
We caught up with some of those kids in St. George.
Once in a while, we have people who come through and realize, you know what, I never want to work this hard again in my life. And then they go and they get a job in a bank. And I think that's a good thing, actually, because sometimes we want to help those people decide that this is not for them.
That was Dave Bastian, the program coordinator for a modern-day conservation corps, the Utah Conservation Corps, or UCC, based at the Utah State University campus in Logan. UCC is a branch of AmeriCorps, a federal government agency created under President Bill Clinton that focuses on education and the maintenance of public lands. And these young men and women are workhorses of conservation.
My name is Adam Stodel. I'm the roving field boss for the Utah Conservation Corps.
Stodel, who works with Bastian, describes his work much the same as old-timer Charlie Wallmeyer's, but with a different motivation.
You know, I feel that conservation was in its infancy with Roosevelt and the Civilian Conservation Corps. You know, they had an interesting way of looking at things, and they were starting to get into some of the soil conservations, erosion control, but a lot of it was trying to get recreation to happen on our natural lands, on our public lands. And so building of reservoirs, building of dams, improving the ability for us, you know, to have agriculture. I feel like conservation then was trying to mold the environment to a way that humans could interact in it in an easier fashion. Now we're just trying to mold our activities so that we can interact with the natural environment easier. So I think that's kind of the major shift. I feel that the heart has always been the same, but the techniques have molded as science and as kind of the sustainable mentality has caught up with us.
It was a typical banquet room, but these men in their 80s and 90s made it lively, swapping stories about their time in the camps, elicited by the speaker of the night, Robert Odrich, author and CCC historian, who shared similar experiences as a Grand Canyon Park Ranger.
Here's the uniform, blue denim. See the hat here? We'll see some more pictures of what the uniform looks like. Again, you've got the guys in uniform. A lot of our infrastructure, our water lines, our sewer lines, our industrial buildings were done by the CCC in the 30s. One historian estimates that in 10 years, we went ahead 50 years. Here's the basics. Got to be between 17 and 25. You got to be from a poor family. You have to be a citizen, no prison record. Have to be in good health, no communicable diseases. Basic things like that. You take an oath that's less than a page long, and you got guaranteed work for 6 months and the ability, perhaps, to learn some new skills to put you back to work.
91-year-old Fred Garcia from Glendale, Arizona, joined the CCC. Just a boy looking for a job.
I was just getting out of high school, 6 months. I got out of high school in June of 37. No jobs, nothing to do, and it was a chance to do something. Also help out the family, because $25 a month was sent to directly to your family, so that was roughly equivalent of a week's wages for my father. So in other words, getting an extra payday a month.
Many historians say that the Great Depression was one of the greatest crises to hit our country since the Civil War. Over 100,000 businesses had failed. Over 5,000 banks had failed. Unemployment was 25%. Now we have a new president. His name is Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Conservation is a favorite thing for him. He had done conservation on his estate in New York. As governor of the state of New York, he had pushed through a bill to put young men to work in state parks and things like that.
Within 2 years, Roosevelt had orchestrated basically a conservation army of over 500,000 men
working in thousands of locations across the U.S. Together, the men cleared 28,000 miles of trails, planted 3 billion trees, built 63,000 buildings, created 800 new state parks still in use today, and constructed 125,000 roads.
Getting used to working with your hands, and especially, it was a toughening up process. I mean, I'm standing in a ditch 7 feet deep, and it's maybe 4 feet wide, and I've got a long-handled shovel, and I'm trying to throw dirt out the top, and that, and splitting rocks and so forth. And, you develop a certain amount of muscle. You usually ended up with one fellow that you sort of buddied around with, and you got along with everybody else. That was one of the things that taught you was how to work and how to get along with people. Look at it this way. Everybody was in the same boat you were. So you weren't exceptional in any way. So it was just a question of getting on.
Fred had a very interesting life in the sense that he went through the CCC. He stayed kind of locally with the CCC, Philadelphia to Virginia. But after that, once he went into the Air Force, he spent 31 years abroad, 31 years living in Europe, living in Africa, working for RCA.
Adam Stodel of the Utah Conservation Corps and Fred Garcia spent the day together comparing notes.
I've been concentrating on conservation corps in the Intermountain West and just thinking about taking that concentration and broadening it out to an area that has a similar climate but may not have a similar conservation mind or may not have that set up with any kind of national preserves or land beautification projects or anything like that in other countries, and taking that abroad. And so I think that international scope is something that I learned from him today, and the fact that you can really just go into anything. He was a mechanic and then got into the Air Force, and the Air Force said that he failed his mechanical aptitude test, and he'd been an auto mechanic for 10 years. And so, it's one of those things where he went into communications, and from that point on, he had his lifelong career. And so it was just kind of random by chance, and he ended up traveling around the world and passing on his knowledge around the world, and I think I'd like to do something similar.
The fact is that Adam might have to diversify sooner than later. UCC accepts only a quarter of the hundreds of applications they get a year. This speaks to the desire of young people who want to get involved in preserving our natural environment. Adam has a job now, but if AmeriCorps gets axed, some people in Congress want to cut it completely right now. UCC would lose 40% of its funding, and America would be passing up a really good deal.
AmeriCorps in the state of Utah is teaching young people to read. It's providing medical services for individuals on the Navajo Nation who have no other access to medical services. It's essentially working with folks like us who are providing both training and work for public lands. And it's doing it in an incredibly economical way.
The director of UCC, Sean DeMitz, in Logan, reports that Corps volunteers generate 15.3 million hours of work and save the government an estimated value of $327 million per year. This core network specializes in preparing youth with on-the-job skills, valuable to our future workforce. Many young people are attracted to this kind of work. According to the UCC, there are three main reasons why they gravitate to agencies like AmeriCorps and UCC. One, they are passionate about the environment and want to give back. Two, they want a career in public land management and get their foot in the door. And three, they are driven by a romantic notion of the West, having just read Desert Solitaire or Kerouac. They're ready for an adventure. Whatever the reason, modern-day corps are approaching conservation genuinely, and they are the laborers keeping our public lands in shape.
People don't realize that there are conservation corps still today, and that we're still doing that same kind of work, building trails, building fence, doing habitat restoration, and it's taking place all over the country. So I'm pretty sure that even though every state doesn't have a corps, there's a corps operating in nearly every state in the country, if not every state in the country. But I do think that, by and large, a lot of folks are not aware of that fact. We'd all love to see that change, I think.
Like Dave Bastian, John Irish is dedicated to the legacy of the CCC. He is founder of the Coquina Rural Environment Corps in Flagstaff, Arizona, and very involved in today's youth corps. He adds they are integral to keeping many rural communities alive.
People come to these remote areas, the small towns, the little villages around the country that are in these, in and around the national forests and national parks to recreate. When they come, they spend their money in the local restaurants, the gas stations, bait shops, all of those places. And what really keeps that industry going are good trails to hike on, scenic parks, well-maintained parks. And so a lot of what these corps do really are rural development, local infrastructure, maintenance and construction.
Okay, welcome to Southern Utah.
That is Marian Jacqueline, who goes by the nickname Omar. She's an archaeologist and the Heritage Program Manager for the Dixie National Forest.
Tour guide Ken Baldridge, one of the organizers of the CCC Legacy Gathering, and MC on the bus, guided us through the CCC camps in the St. George area with impeccable detail while sporting a 10-gallon cowboy hat.
Let me explain about the camp itself. This is one of the later camps. It actually began in October of 1939. It was one of the last camps to close down. It didn't close down until May of 1942, and the property was turned over to the Army. And one of their first jobs was to build a half-mile road, paved road, connecting the camp with the pavement of the roads in Hurricane. This was DG 160, and it was Fifth Corps area camp. Most of the boys were from Ohio, some from Kentucky, some from Indiana, even two from Mississippi. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure how they got in here, but that was the makeup of the camp.
What his beef was with Mississippi, we'll never know. The bus was full of CCC men and their sons and daughters. The men were stationed from 6 months to 2 years at any given camp. But it was obvious, this short assignment, but an impact, that its effects lasted generations.
My name is Kathleen Duxbury-Yaw, and I am from Ridgewood, New Jersey. I am a CCC baby. My father was George Duxbury, and he volunteered for four enrollments. Starting in 1937, he was a orphan from New York City. He was from Brooklyn. And he went into the CCC, and it gave him stability, and he was forever grateful. He was the only son of an only son. And by 1937, everyone was dead. They were all deceased. And if you were on, you know, if you were 17, 18 in 1937, at the height of the Depression, you were on your own. He was on his own. So it, and he would spoke of it as the happiest period in his youth, and it prepared him well. He had a garden all his life ever since, so he was very happy because of it. He had three photo albums, and several years ago I came across the photo albums, and I do have vivid memories of him telling me of the happy times, but of course I never understood it. I was too young, or maybe I was just too thick.
Duxbury started researching the CCC and discovered the government had hired a very select group of artists to make a pictorial record of what the C's were accomplishing at the camps.
This has changed actually my life and that of my husband, Gardner, who retired last year. We are traveling in a 1983 vintage Wander Lodge bus by the Bluebird Bus Company. And we're traveling, which allows us to stay in state and national parks, which is where the CCC boys are. And we've been told that Ralph Cramden would be very comfortable at the wheel of this bus. It's that old.
Ralph Cramden, played by actor Jackie Gleason, was a short-tempered bus driver on a 1950s sitcom, The Honeymooners. We asked how and if the Wander Lodge was holding up.
Oh, no. no, it's constant problem. You know, my husband likens the bus to a house on wheels that experiences multiple earthquakes every day. Something is always shaking loose. I mean, there's always something. We pull behind us a Jeep, a 1995 Jeep that my husband refers to as his little red toolbox.
Kathleen and her husband started their investigations in their home state, New Jersey, and are visiting CCC camps across the country, where these artists are known to have worked.
We're looking for the art, the artists, and the story. Roosevelt did not call them unemployed. He did not call them relief. He referred to them as idle artists, and that is the title of my research, Idle Artists of the Great Depression, a pictorial record of the Civilian Conservation Corps. am absolutely humbled just by the CCC in general. It was a remarkable program. I mean, just the boys that were with today, my father, I mean, people say they saved America. I believe they did. I believe America was a country that was blowing and floating away, certainly in the Great Depression. And the artists themselves, it's remarkable.
Many of the sites of the old camps we visited are now golf courses and housing developments. The physical record has long been washed away, and only stories and memories are left. What Joan Sharp, the president of the Civilian Conservation Corps legacy, is dedicated to preserving in order to pass the conservation torch onto younger generations.
They and their heritage now depend on us because they believe that the CCC story changed their life. And of course, as an organization, the Civilian Conservation Corps legacy, it's our job to make sure that the history of the CCC isn't forgotten. And part of that is to reach out to corps like the Utah Conservation Corps to make sure that people know about it. You know, there's not a lot of people that understand that there is a modern corps system out there. I sit at my desk every day and somebody will call and say they need another corps. You know, if you would read the paper, if you would pay attention to what's being said in the news and things, you would know that there is a lot of really good kids out there working in conservation, and it's already here. The question is, how do we tell that story to the American public? How do we tell it to our legislators? How do we let America know that it's already happening?
Dave Bastian agrees. Most of the work they do remains under the radar. They are often pulling 60-hour weeks, carrying heavy equipment deep into wilderness study areas, teaching and training young people hard skills, and instilling a sense of obligation to conservation and preservation of America's pristine wilderness.
We take young folks from all over the country and we put them to work on public lands, what I describe as the most beautiful public lands in America. And we work for nearly every national park in the state. We work for all the federal agencies, Forest Service, BLM, National Park Service. We work for municipalities such as Salt Lake City, Salt Lake County. We cover, and then we actually also get a little bit into Idaho, Wyoming, and Arizona a bit.
Bastian's colleague, Nicole Ashton, is a field boss for the UCC. She symbolizes the essence of the difference between the old CCC and the modern day Corps.
I've always kind of been involved in man's work. Learning a lot of new skills and being able to dive in right in there with the guys, you know, learn how to run a chainsaw and then helped with the training this fall with the chainsaw and stuff. And it's always really fun to surprise the guys with what we're capable of doing. Just the other week, we had some 80-pound bags of cement that we needed to move down the hill, and one of the crew leaders had said to me, "Well, we'll get somebody to help you with those bags." And when he came back, I was, you know, carrying them over my shoulder, like down the hill, and he was like, "I'm sorry that I said that we would get help for you. Obviously, you didn't need it." And I was just like, "Yeah, you know, that's right. I don't." So it's definitely fun, and I think that it's really good for girls to see that. And with the bilingual youth corps we actually had more girls than we did boys. And you'd get these girls swinging axes and doing all this stuff, and it really, I think, it's empowering for them, and it's empowering for me to, you know, have these different doors open to me. Or to girls to see, you know, you can do this.
One of the biggest things I get out of being in this position with the Utah Conservation Corps is seeing those aha moments in my corps members when they really develop not just the ability to conduct a new skill, but the confidence in themselves that's developed by obtaining those new skills. So it's the hardest, but also the most rewarding.
That was Adam Trenzo, a UCC field boss in Moab. It is this sense of pride in the old and the young that has cultivated guardians of America's lands across the 20th and 21st centuries. It is a lifestyle that isn't for the weary.
My name, Richard B. Kreisinger. My birthday, 2 July, 1922. One of the main things it taught me was discipline and how to become a leader. I'll be 90 at my next birthday. I served in three base camps, one spike camp, and one district headquarters. First base camp was Camp Rusk, Company 3652, Rusk County, Wisconsin. I spent 6 months there in the heart of winter. Cold, cold, cold. Minus 40 was nothing uncommon. I like to froze to death. I had a series of nosebleeds too, and I got damn hungry. Being a young boy of 14, it got a little touchy. During that time, I played in the kitchen, doing the pots and pans, taking care of the cooks and the bakers.
Richard's grandmother forged papers in order for him to enroll in the CCC at the age of 15, pretending he was 18. The CCC boys made $30 a month, and 25 of that was automatically sent home to their families. Estranged from his father and on the move, the CCC was a refuge from train hopping and homelessness for Richard that started when he was only 14.
My parents were divorced, and I had problems with my mother. And during the divorce proceedings, my father used the wrong psychology on me. So I was a high school dropout in my freshman year. I rode the rods across the United States. I was a young hobo at the age of 14.
Well, Mac, the Viper said I've been in the mooch. I'm tired of you smoking and all my hoots. Gonna take my raise, gonna give you the goose.
Richard's service in the CCC Corps changed his track, and he went on to serve the country in three major wars, World War II, the Korean War, and Vietnam. The CCC gave young men hope and discipline, transforming a trail-hopping hobo into a decorous soldier.
Bunch of country and city kids with no work, families near starving, are gonna get paid $30 a month and send 25 home to their families. They're going to join this corps and fix up forests and mountains and roads and dams and all sorts of things. And yes, the government is paying for that. You mean it's like the army? Shouted Zeke. Well, the war fellows are handling it with rules and disciplines, but it's called the Civilian Conservation Corps, shouted another voice.
That was Judith Edwards, actress and author of Invasion on the Mountain, The Adventures of Will Ryan and the Civilian Conservation Corps, the first in a three-part series. The story is about a boy who gets involved with the CCC and takes place on Scutney Mountain. And near the mountain is a small town where Judy currently lives, and also home to one of the first CCC camps in the United States. The CCC activity on the mountain helps the young boy and gives him purpose during a time where jobs were scarce and people were depressed. And in reality, the CCC Public Relief Program gave purpose to tens of thousands of young men. It was a divisive decision by Roosevelt to pour taxpayers' money into unskilled manual labor jobs, boosting the economy.
I think that's one of the reasons I've gotten so involved with the Civilian Conservation Corps and why I'm in Utah at the moment. My family were very Republican. I am very Democrat. And they were ranchers in Colorado. And so when the WPA gave all these people money, my family, who when the ranch didn't work, they'd go and work in the steel mills, got very upset and became Republicans. They had been Democrats. And they moved to California. So growing up, the worst word in the world was Roosevelt, said that way. It's a little hard for me to say Roosevelt, which is the way you're supposed to say it. So I don't think we could ever repeat the CCC in the first place. Can you see a president getting in there on getting elected March 4th and then By March 31, the Civilian Conservation Corps existed because he'd gotten the Congress involved. He'd suggested the idea. The Congress got involved. The cabinet approved. The Congress got involved. The Congress voted for it. The bill was passed, and it started.
America is facing the same decisions today. Do we cut AmeriCorps in tough times, or do we pull a Roosevelt? Certainly the old boys of the CCC are a living legacy of the benefits of building up our youth and of putting our energies into conservation and the mentality of conservation. The fruits of their labor, their blood, sweat, and tears, are the roads we all travel.
Thank you for listening. For SQ Radio, this is Sherry Quinn and Susie Montgomery.
Across the street from the camp was a mechanic shop, and we found the most gorgeous lead crystal whiskey bottles wrapped up in their pant legs of their uniforms. Still there and in evidence. There was also supposed to be no gambling, but we found a whole cache of washers that had little marks put on them where they had been gambling. So
hey, you're ruining a reputation.
I know!
We wouldn't do things like that.
You guys wouldn't do things like that.
Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.